Collateral damage from the Bangladeshi garment factory fire continues to spread. From APM, this is the Marketplace Midday Update. I'm Jeff Horwich, and it is the 28th of November, a Wednesday. We're also going to talk about a new penalty for BP announced this morning. Royalties from online radio stations, the Pope Mobile, why Europeans seem to have a thing for dousing each other with milk. And then we will move on to the main event, the Oracle of Omaha, the Magician of the Midwest, the Prognosticator of the Plains, the Billionaire of the Breadbasket. I could go on, but you know who I'm talking about. Warren Buffett. We talked to him, and that conversation will be a good chunk of today's podcast.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
Police in Bangladesh today arrested three supervisors at the garment factory where a fire killed more than 100 workers over the weekend. They allegedly blocked exits that might have helped more of those people escape. The clothing industry in Bangladesh is a huge supplier to the American market. Walmart says some of its clothes were made at this particular factory, though it was done without the company's authorization. And this morning, more companies are being pulled into the tragedy, including Sears, Disney, and a brand owned by the rapper Sean Combs. From our Wealth and Poverty Desk, Marketplace's Chrissy Clark reports on what the implications could be for the U.S. clothing industry.
Every day for the last week, retail industry analyst Bert Flickinger and his team at Strategic Resource Group have been out in stores across the country tallying holiday shoppers. On Monday, after news came out that piles of Walmart brand shorts had been found in the ashes of the factory fire in Bangladesh, they noticed something at the company's stores.
Customer counts in the apparel sections have been very weak.
He thinks at least part of the weak numbers come from losing shoppers troubled by news of the fire and conditions in the factory.
Particularly with women and students who can make up to 80% of purchase decisions on apparel and accessories.
Since the fire, both Walmart and Sears have made it clear they cut ties with the factory months ago, but a subcontractor sent work there anyway without their knowledge. Judy Gearhart with the International Labor Rights Forum says if factory workers had more of a voice, then Sears and Walmart
would have known, because workers can tell you that.
At least 500 people have died in garment factory accidents in Bangladesh since 2006. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
BP has already agreed to pay the biggest criminal penalty in history for its role in the 2010 Gulf oil spill. Now this morning, news that BP's been slapped with a ban on doing business with the U.S. government. No more government contracts, no loans or grants, at least for a while. BP's based in the U.K., and Marketplace's Stephen Beard has followed all the company's recent travails for us from London. Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Jeff.
So this government contracting ban here in the U.S., was this just a bolt out of the blue for BP?
Not really, no. This is not a huge surprise. When it settled those criminal charges with the Department of Justice a couple of weeks ago, BP acknowledged that some kind of contract ban was likely. The Environmental Protection Agency says it's imposed the ban because of what it calls the lack of integrity the company showed in the run-up to the disaster in the Gulf and in the aftermath. The EPA says it will lift the suspension when BP demonstrates that it's raised its game. So this is a temporary ban, and it does not affect existing contracts.
Is it mostly just a symbolic punishment, you think, or will BP wind up paying a real additional financial price here?
Analysts here say this isn't a terrific blow, although actually BP's share price did fall quite sharply on the news. It bounced back a little bit. But analysts are saying that, first of all, one of BP's biggest federal contracts is with the Department of Defense. Last year, it supplied the Pentagon with more than $1 billion worth of fuel. Neil Atkinson, an oil expert with Data Monitor, the information group, says the Pentagon will be very reluctant to scale back its business with BP.
The military will have bases of one type or another, which are very conveniently located in relation to BP infrastructure. So I wouldn't expect that the BP military contracts would come under pressure in the short term.
So he says the contract ban may not prove that serious, but he stresses BP certainly isn't out of the woods. Next year, there's a civil case looming, and that, if it goes to court, could have BP paying up to $21 billion in damages. Now, that would be a major blow.
Marketplace's London Bureau Chief, Stephen Beard, thank you very much.
Okay, Jeff.
And let's do the numbers. Well, markets have been down for most of the morning up to this point, although they've pulled themselves nearly level as I'm speaking currently. The Dow is at 12,870, and it's basically flat. The S&P 500 is down about 0.25%, though, as is the NASDAQ. This hour, we got a little bit cooler news on the housing recovery. Sales of new homes fell slightly last month, and they didn't grow as fast in September as previously estimated. And applications for home mortgage refinances also fell last week, maybe a sign most people who intend to take advantage of the current low rates have already done so. Mortgages for new home purchases, however, continued to increase. This week, we're bringing you a series of stories on the auto industry in Europe. It's now going through a crisis similar to the one U.S. car makers weathered 4 years ago. Today we go to France to hear how car makers' efforts to cut costs run up against European politics. Here's reporter Christopher Wirth.
It's the afternoon shift change at this Peugeot factory in Aulnay-sous-Bois, just outside Paris. Workers walk in and out of the factory gates as union members hand out leaflets and sing an old working man's tune.
I kiss my girl by the factory hall, dirty old town, dirty old town.
This dirty old town has a bleak future. Peugeot plans to close the factory here, the place where Patrice San has worked for the past 17 years. So he's come out to fight for his own job and those of the roughly 3,000 others who work here.
It would be the best if we can keep the plant. It will be difficult, but there is no good reason to close this plant. It's only for money.
A lot of money from Peugeot's perspective. Car sales in Europe have nosedived throughout the debt crisis. Peugeot is losing roughly $250 million a month and desperately needs to reduce costs. Overall, the company says it wants to shed 8,000 jobs. Anne-Laure Descleves is a Peugeot spokesperson.
It is the only option that we have for Peugeot's long-term survival. So we will do it even if it is painful.
But closing a factory in Europe is never easy. Unemployment in France is over 10%. French President François Hollande called Peugeot's plans unacceptable, and he could have a say in the matter. Last month, Peugeot secured a $9 billion lifeline from the French government. That will keep Peugeot out of bankruptcy. But in return, French politicians will demand the company keep jobs, not cut them, says Philippe Bourgeois, an auto analyst at UBS.
The side effect of this support is that it constrains the ability of Peugeot to restructure and become profitable again on its own.
And if it's not profitable, the company can't invest in new models once the European market recovers, a vicious spiral that, Bourgeois says, Peugeot may never recover from. In Aulnay-sous-Bois, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
And let's remain in Europe for just a moment here, where this week they are covering themselves with milk. First, there's this new trend called milking, which, if you haven't seen it yet online, seems to involve British people dumping a gallon of milk over their heads in a public place. Milking coming soon to the United States, I'm sure. And then to Brussels, where dairy farmers descended on the EU's headquarters to protest agricultural policies. Their weapon of choice, of course, fire hoses loaded with milk, which was sprayed upon the European Parliament to the tune of thousands of gallons. No word on whether lawmakers plan to change any policies as a result of the protest, or whether they are, you might say, lactose intolerant.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
Old-fashioned terrestrial radio stations don't pay royalties directly to musicians. They pay them to the music publishers. But online radio stations do have to pay artists. And they complain that makes it hard to turn a profit. This morning, a House subcommittee considered a bill that would slash the royalties that online radio stations pay. Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
When one of cellist Zoe Keating's songs plays on internet radio, she gets just a fraction of a cent in royalties. She recently got a royalty check for the first 6 months of this year.
I had 1.5 million streams, and I got a check for $1,650.
Keating is a full-time musician, supporting her husband and toddler son, so $1,600 doesn't go too far. But the internet radio sites say they're struggling too. They're required to pay more in royalties than satellite and cable radio outlets. The Internet Radio Fairness Act would even things out. Some webcasters say they'll go out of business if they have to keep paying the higher rate. Kurt Hansen is founder and CEO of AccuRadio.
The royalty rates are so high that it's almost impossible for webcasters to build a business.
Musicians like Zoe Keating are against the bill, but she says she would compromise, accepting lower royalties in exchange for more information on her fans, so she could make money by inviting them to concerts or alerting them to new songs they could buy. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
This afternoon, President Obama welcomes more business leaders to the White House to talk about what else? The fiscal cliff. One business leader who's been no stranger to Obama lately is Warren Buffett. The Oracle of Omaha continued his advocacy in Sunday's New York Times, saying increased taxes on the wealthy will do nothing to dull U.S. economic activity. So he says. Yesterday, Marketplace talked with Warren Buffett and with Fortune magazine's Carol Loomis. Loomis has just written a book about Buffett called Tap Dancing to Work. My Morning Report colleague Jeremy Hobson takes it from here.
Do you think the fiscal cliff is going to be avoided this year?
I don't know the answer to that, but we may run over a little bit. We're not going to run over by 6 months or anything of the sort. So it may be that it requires the passage of New Year's Eve to get people to act, but it will not be something that we're talking about a year from now.
How do you think we get past this gridlock in Washington that has really created so much uncertainty for business in this country?
Yeah, well, we finally get 535 or a majority of 535 people to realize that they really have to behave like grown-ups, and they have to raise perhaps 18.5% of GDP in revenues, and they can spend 21%. And if they do that, they'll have a happy household. And if they're no matter how rich a household is, if it spends way more than it takes in, you know, it's going to be unhappy, and it's going to have a lot of unhappy members. And it's not a complicated proposition, and they really all know the equation. We'll get an answer.
How do you think we can get back to 4% growth or more in this country?
Well, 4% is a pretty big number.
But these days.
But even take a subpar 2%. If we have 1% population growth and we have 2% real growth in output, that's 20% in 20 years. If every generation lives 20% better than the generation before, that is not bad. I think we'll do better than that. But 20% in a generation is not bad.
What's your biggest economic concern in the year ahead?
Well, I think that we run the risk always of substantial inflation, but not immediate. But it's so much easier for legislators to print money to try and solve problems, and it solves them for a very short period. I mean, it feels very good. If I had a printing press in my basement, I mean, I'd probably use it. So I can't really condemn those legislators. But I think that in a democracy, it's always looms as a threat, and only vigilance on the part of legislators and the Federal Reserve and really the public will keep it from being abused at some point.
Carol Loomis, what's the best year that he's had since you've known him?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I'd have to have the annual report. Warren, help me out. What is the best year you've had?
The best year I've ever had was 1954. That actually was the best year for the stock market in my history.
Huh.
I did almost 100 percentage points better than the than the Dow Jones average in that year.
And what was it about? How did you do that?
Well, I was working with a very small amount of money. That made it a lot easier. But listen, the best year is the next year.
You're always looking forward to the
absolutely.
Best year. Absolutely. And what about the worst year?
What's been the toughest
year for you?
Worst business year. Worst year personally is when somebody close to me would die,
sure.
Obviously. But the best – worst year – statistically, perhaps 1999 or some year like that when the internet bubble was on and we weren't participating. But that doesn't really make any difference to me. I'm looking at what I'm doing with the money, and if I feel satisfied with it, what other people are doing does not bother me.
That's investor Warren Buffett talking with Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy's conversation with him and his biographer also got into more personal territory, and here now is a little part of that conversation. Among other things, Jeremy asked Warren Buffett what he knows about the economy that nobody else does.
Well, I don't think it. I have an overriding view that there's never been an economy like the American economy, and that basically we're just getting started. We have a system that unlocks human potential. It's been doing it for a couple hundred years. It's going to do it for many hundred years to come. But I don't think that view is unique to me. But I do hold it consistently. And then I look at individual businesses as we go along to try and figure out ones that are going to do very well over time.
But you've done much better than a lot of other people.
Well, I haven't been swayed by emotion as much as other people. It doesn't require any brains to figure out 15 years ago that maybe Coca-Cola has got something that's going to sell a little bit in the future. I don't get carried away with trends or get envious of how people are making money in something that I don't understand. I sort of stick with what I understand.
You're just thinking long term all the time.
Yeah. But why not? I mean, if you buy a farm, you think long term. If you buy an apartment house, you think long term. Why shouldn't you think long term if you buy a piece of a business called a stock?
Carol Loomis, what do you think? What do you think he gets that nobody else seems to get?
Well, I think he has an upbeat personality, but it's really grounded in rationality and intelligence. And I'm sure I've been swayed by him, but I really believe in what he says and that he's thought it through. And I would agree. I'm bullish about the economy as well.
Is there something about being in Omaha that helps? That is, you're not in the Northeast bubble as so many of your colleagues are.
I think it helps to be away from lots of chatter, no matter where it may be. So, I mean, whether it's Los Angeles or New York or you name it, I don't want to hear what a lot of other people think. I just want a lot of facts, and I want to sit there unaffected by whether it's sunny or cloudy outside or anything of the sort, and certainly unaffected by whether the people around me are feeling great or feeling terrible. And I just want to look at the facts and see where they lead me.
Well, on that note, I saw in the book back in the 80s, you wrote, "We don't make judgments based on ratings. If we wanted Moody's or S&P to run our money, we'd give it to them." So you're doing your own research.
Yeah,
you're not focusing on these rating agencies.
I don't care what other people think at all. I mean, in the end, I'm not handing my money over to anybody else or my shareholders' money. So if I can't understand it myself, I'm not going to do anything based on somebody else's view.
Do you think the ratings agencies serve any purpose?
Well, they serve a purpose, but they don't serve a purpose for me.
Do you think Wall Street is still in the business of creating capital for businesses?
Well, it does that. But it people, when they buy stocks and sell them a week later or a month later or have target prices for them or all that, it's basically it borders on gambling, and sometimes it's outright gambling. People love to gamble. I mean, you know, people travel thousands of miles to go and do unintelligent things, you know.
Yeah.
and so it's a very human characteristic, but it can be expensive if done any place, and particularly in the stock market.
That's Warren Buffett talking with my Morning Report colleague, Jeremy Hobson. And finally, wrapping up here, apropos of nothing, particularly not Warren Buffett, the former Popemobile is headed for a new life. This is the Popemobile that was used up until 1981, when an assassination attempt caused the switch to a new bulletproof version. According to the HuffPost UK, the Dublin Wax Museum now owns that Popemobile, and they're going to start renting it out for parties for about the same rate as a stretch limo. The museum promises to use the Popemobile in a way, quote, respectful to what it was, but its website also does point out that it would be a great option for your prom night. That's all for the Marketplace Midday Update today. I'm Jeff Horwich. This is APM, American Public Media.